The vibrant debate on socio-economic condition in early medieval India suddenly comes to a halt at the end of the 12th century. The description is taken over from here by scholars working on the Delhi Sultanate. And we see that there are many great Persian knowing historians like Muhammad Habib and later on the history was taken over from him by historians like Irfan Habib. They wrote a lot on the Delhi Sultanate and the Mughal Empire. So their major emphasis was that the Sultanate brought about the creation of a new system of agrarian exploitation with a parasitical urban growth based upon it. To these Persian scholars, to these medieval historians, the political power was actually united with economic power more fully than ever before. So it basically talked about vesting of the control over the bulk of the surplus in the hands of the ruling class. Now, they also designate the economic organization establishment under the Sultanate as the Indian medieval economy, which was actually slightly different from the early medieval economic system, wherein many historians talked about the Indian feudalism, or then there was a revisionist group of historians who said that, you know, the feudalism never existed. Then there were, you know, also historians who talked about the integration of political structure in those period. So in its essential feature, the economy, according to the medieval scholars, continued to function in the Delhi Sultanate, and then it continued under the Mughal Empire. There were certain historians like K.S. Lal who questioned this whole idea of economic progress under the Delhi Sultanate, and they came up with some data about the military campaigns and the devastations which were caused under Delhi Sultanate. Although historians like Irfan Habib questioned these evidences by K.S. Lal and other historians by suggesting that in order to establish that these were on a large scale, devastations or the military campaigns were on the larger scales, one should come up with such similar data even for the 9th and the 10th century. I think this very explanation problematic because, instead of putting up evidences that devastation on large scale did not happen under Delhi Sultan, Irfan Habib tries to find fault lines in earlier period. Now, basically, if we read the history through the eyes of many great mainstream medieval historians, we find that the methodology followed by these historians is that of, culling out ready-made facts from many of the Persian chronicles. So they're basically mining some kind of ready-made facts from the historical sources. There are, historians who say that this is a kind of source which we call as source, the chronicles which are used as a source, these are authoritative sources. So these are the writings of history from authorities. This is what, historians suggest. Peter Hardy has given a very interesting explanation about this common sense theory of historical writing, and he cites R.G. Collingwood wherein Collingwood in his book Idea of History has defined this common sense theory of history writing. Collingwood says that that the essential thing in history are memory and authority. If an event or a state of things is to be historically known, first of all, someone must be acquainted with it. And then he must remember it. And then he must state it. So, the very statement of the facts is considered to be history. I mean, this is, Collingwood says these are the traditional way of writing history. And then he says that, finally what happens that the other must accept the statement as true. So the moment historian writes his history based on the given facts, the given historical, using the historical evidences from the past, it becomes a statement of truth. History, according to Collingwood, is thus the believing of someone else when he says that he remembers something. So the believer is actually the historian. The person believes is called authority. And this, this entire doctrine of the common sense theory implies that the historical truth, so far as it is at all accessible to the historian, is accessible to him only, because it exists ready-made in the ready-made statements of his authorities. Now, these statements are to him a sacred text whose value depends wholly on the unbrokenness of the tradition they represent. So the historian, what he does is that he does not try to tamper with the account, the evidences that he gets in the chronicles. So he does not mutilate them. He just takes the facts given as it is, and then the modern historian tries to write them. In that sense, the historian actually does not contradict the evidences given by the medieval chroniclers. Now, no writer on the history of medieval India has acted wholly upon this obviously naive theory of the way to reach the historical truth. But we find that much of the writings that have come up by the modern day scholars, what we call as the mainstream histories of medieval India, the majority of them have in fact treated the medieval Indo-Persian histories as sources. So these are considered sources for writing political history. So, and what we see is that while we write such histories, we find that there has been some kind of a compilation which has taken place. So Peter Hardy calls this as a method of scissors and paste, right? Collingwood, in fact, has given a very pointed definition of this kind of an assumption of, using of such sources for writing the histories. Collingwood says that the method by which it proceeds is first to decide what we want to know about, and then to go in search of statements about it, whether it is oral or written. Having found in such statement something which is relevant to this purpose, the historian then excerpts it and then incorporates it, sometimes translates also if it is required, and then recasts it into what he considered as a suitable style. So this is his own history. So then the modern historian writes his history based on those sources as his own history. So what happens that as a rule, where the historian has many statements to draw upon, he or she will find that one of them tells him or her what another does not. So both, or in fact all of them, will be incorporated. So all the facts, all the evidences, all the, you know, evidences from the chronicles would be incorporated. And sometimes then the historian will find that one of them contradicts the another. And then unless he can find a way of reconciling them, he must then decide to leave one out. And this is because this is the way the modern historian works. So basically it involves him in a critical consideration of the contradictory authorities relative to the degree of trustworthiness. So, Peter Hardy says that this is a method of scissor and paste. And this was a method which was very popular before the 17th century in the Middle Ages. Collingwood, in fact, writes that in the 17th century, it was realized that a systematic examination of the authorities was necessary in order to determine the credibility. So what happens that as soon as it becomes understood that the given statement made by a given author must never be accepted for historical truth until the credibility of the author in general, of his statement, or in particular of any kind of a statement, it cannot be accepted as historical truth. So then, people started talking about the authority. So the earlier version of authority, which was considered as a source, it actually disappeared. Now, then the document which was earlier known as authority now acquired a new status, and it was then termed as a source. So Collingwood says that there is not much of a difference that is happening after post-17th century. We have only changed some kind of a terminology. So earlier we were using it as authority. Now the term, the new term has been used as a source. But, the basic nature of the use of these sources remain the same. So, this is some kind of an acceptance of certified testimony of the sources. The historian, what he does, the modern historian, is that he uses those, these sources through his own screening processes. Now, that this kind of a historical methodology, which has been one of the most normally employed way used by the modern day historians of medieval India, may be seen in many of the works of later day, historians like, historians like the Ishwari Prasad, or maybe Muhammad Habib, or even Irfan Habib. You can look at these works and you will find that they have been, critical of the sources. They have been the people who have tried to critically understand those sources and then use those sources to reach to their history, to their understanding of history. It is interesting that most of the modern-day historians have used the Persian chronicles, such as, Tariqa Ferushai, as certified source. The source writer could have been, honestly mistaken, even though his statements are nowhere contradicted. They are manifestly incredible or apparently made in bad faith. So this is quite possible. And the historian is still a believer. This historian is, what he writes will fall below what is required by the canons of critical thinking. The limits of the visions of the modern day historians are actually determined by the spectacles, or you know what Peter Hardy calls as the blinkers. So his sources are actually some kind of the blinkers, which his sources actually provide. So should the historian surrender himself to this his sources in this way? And is it the right way? This is something which has been questioned by many revisionist historians. Because modern day historians also, the revisionist historians also believe that there is a a possibility that the sources that we have been using, the Persian chronicles that we have been using to write the medieval history, they may not mention many of the things. Because the historian of that period would not have written those things because it was injudicious to mention it. Now, it is because of these limitations that the, you know, the writings which try to glorify the Delhi Sultanate and the Mughal Empire as the two very prominent and very powerful empires is questioned. Because the way, because these two empires had their, well-structured Persian narratives, and the historians have used those Persian narratives to write the history of medieval India. That does not mean that other, regional state did not exist.
There is no doubt that the establishment of Delhi Sultanate was a very significant development in terms of polity and socio-economic history of North India. One question that always intrigues many of us is that why we hear of a variety of source material under Delhi Sultanate's rule, or for that matter under the Mughal Empire. And these sources, when I'm talking about the source material, these are other than inscriptions, coins and monuments. So the majority of source that the historians have till now relied upon is the numerous chronicles and the written records. In fact, there is a sudden profusion of literature and chronicles during the 13th and the 14th centuries, and even in the 17th centuries. Historians working on 7th and 8th century through the 12th century, as we know, relied primarily on epigraphic, numismatic and archaeological sources. So when historians attempt to generalize and do a theoretical framework from such data, it sometimes lead to contradictory conclusions, and that's why we say we see so much of debate on Indian feudalism. On during this early medieval period history, we have debates on integrative polity and the free peasant economy. The Persian chronicles provide evidence and descriptions which are quite contrary to the epigraphic and archaeological sources, because they are more structured. The very extensive and detailed description of the polity and economy of the period has led the epigraphic sources to play only a secondary and corroborative role. You know, this Tawarikh tradition, the tradition of writing history under Delhi Sultanate, facilitated in formulating and producing chronological history of Delhi Sultanate, and there is no doubt about it. And of course, all these Persian literatures written under Delhi Sultanate were influenced by Iranian and Islamic tradition, which was based on genealogy. The introduction of paper material also provided an added impetus to such writing and such writing practices during Delhi Sultanate. The availability of written narratives is of tremendous help for studying the history of Delhi Sultanate, and nobody doubts it. However, it also presents serious problems. As we have seen, many historians have started questioning the way sources have been used to write the history of Delhi Sultanate and the Mughal Empire. Peter Ardi has pointed out that the lack of documentary evidence in the Sultanate text casts a shadow of doubt on what we understand to be the modern standards of objectivity. Most often, modern historians have the tendency to paraphrase the existing histories, and they provide them with a semblance of modernity. As a result, the social and political outlook of medieval historians is not really understood in the correct perspective. So, Peter Hardy argues that the prejudices of medieval chronicle could well leak into modern works, and this can result in a very erroneous view of history. So, the advantage of having written accounts could well become a disadvantage if it is not understood in a contemporary context. E.H. Carr, if you remember, has suggested in his book, What is History, that it makes more sense to study the historian before you study the facts. Therefore, before depending so much on medieval chronicles, it must be agreed that historians' political, social, and class affiliations and his affinities molded his work. Why he was writing, for whom the historian was writing, these are very essential questions to reckon with before we put a Persian chronicler's work to any use. An individual who was writing a few centuries ago was reacting in his own personal and subjective manner to events and situations, and this is very much possible in such chronicles that we find during medieval period. This was actually the historian's choice of that period, that who he decides is important. He decides what was not important, and it is that historian who has decided which, you know, the information that are not to be included in a written record. So we need to try and find out what the historian's idea of history was and what he was essentially trying to say. We should also try to understand the sources from which the historians collected information, the veracity of these accounts, and the manner in which an event was rated in terms of its importance to history. So Peter Hardy, in fact, criticizes scholars who expect to be supplied with ready-made informations. Now, one more way we can add richness to medieval history and early modern history is by using different regional sources. Now, of course, the regional sources that we have are not so well structured as we find in the case of Delhi Sultanate and the Mughal Chronicles. Therefore, it is essential for us to rely on other sources. And these other sources could well be the vernacular literatures, these could well be the epigraphic records, and these could well be the archaeological sources. Now, let us try to understand how, other than political and economic histories based on chronicles, could be used as a source for writing the history of forests, rivers, land, irrigation networks, even the wild animals and many other, you know, nature aspects. It is very difficult to determine the extent of cultivation under Delhi Sultanate and the areas which was under forest and untilled on the basis of Delhi Sultanate sources. However, indirect references could be deduced from the Persian texts. Ibn Battuta's Rihala could also be used to get an idea of forest area and the cultivable area. We get reference to, obviously indirect references, to many of the wild animals and the forest area. For example, Ibn Battuta encounters with a rhinoceros near Multan after he crossed the river Indus. In eastern part, his party was attacked by a rhinoceros in the bamboo canes forest area near Bahraj, which is in the northeast UP. Similarly, if we look at another very interesting account of CG's Fawadul Fawad, we get reference to tiger between Delhi and Badayun, which is in western UP, which is referred to as posing a danger to many of the travelers. Again, Afif in Tariq-e-Firozshahi mentions that wild asses, which are now visible in the Kutch area only, they roamed in the large waterless track between Deepalpur and Sarsati, which is southeast Punjab and southwest Haryana. The chronicler also mentions that Badayun and the surrounding area was a wild forest where Firuz Shah Tughlaq went for hunting. Then regions towards the east of Delhi was a forest area which has been mentioned by Ziauddin Birni. Birni mentions that Ganga Yamuna Doab region was full of forest and refractory elements took refuge in these forests under Balban. Under Muhammad Shah Tughlaq, the village headmen took refuge in these forests when they were asked to pay more taxes. So when they were overtaxed, these village people went and took refuge in the forest. This has been mentioned very categorically by Birni. Birni also mentions that the thick forest between Rohilkhand and Badayun existed during those times. Then Minhaj Siraj Jani in his Tabakate Nasiri talks about the lower Doab area between Kara, which is actually Allahabad, modern day Allahabad, and Kalinjar. He mentions that it was a dense forest area. And if we read Sharhindi, who wrote Tariq-e-Mubarak-Shahi somewhere in the middle of 15th century, he mentions about, you know, some 48 kilometer stretch of forest around Bareilly area, which he mentions as Onola. Similarly, we also get some mentions about the huge area of Haryana and southeastern Punjab, where later canals were dug up by Firuz Shah Tughlaq. This has been mentioned by Birni as an area which was a dry area and which remained until before Firuz Shah Tughlaq came and constructed the canals. So it was after the construction of the canal that these until land were then converted into agricultural land. Birni in fact informs us that this entire area of Haryana and southeastern Punjab, a huge area, had no ponds and there were no wells in those areas, and it was full of wasteland and deserts. Later on, Afif also informs that a huge area between Dipalpur and Sarsati was waterless, where the wild ass lived. He calls it as a desert. He uses a term called Be'ab, that is without water, and informs that even if one dug some 100 gaz or 50 meters, they failed to find any water. So even during those days, 150 meters was a huge task of, digging wells of 50 meters during those years was, it's not like, you know, today we can dig bore wells to many hundred meters. So in medieval times, it was a very difficult task of digging those deep wells. Afif also writes that an area around Hisar Firoza, which is now known as Hisar, the modern district of Hisar in Haryana, one jar of water was sold at 4 jital to travelers, meaning thereby that, you know, the water was so scarce in that area. And it was only after Firuz Shah Tughlaq dug up a canal in that area, which went passed through Hisar, that water became available. The early sultans of Delhi looked up to cultivation as a primary source of revenue, because without cultivation, they could not have maintained their huge army. They were not in a position to contribute substantially any further in regard to the crops sown or the manner in which they were sown or harvested. So for almost 100 years, if we look at the Persian chronicles of the time, we find that for almost a century till the Khalji rule, the Delhi Sultan envisaged a policy aiming at extension of land. So there was massive expansion of the agricultural land. The later phase saw multiplication and improvement in the cropping pattern. So now, once their land was expanded in major part of North India, wheat and cash crops were sowed, and they began to be more important. So historians like Naqvi, Hamida Khatun Naqvi, they believe that Delhi Sultanate agricultural policy could be understood in two phases, two broader phases. One that was extension of land under cultivation, and then the reclamation schemes, the second one, which is accompanied with emphasis on improvement in the cropping pattern. So it is in the second phase that we find that the cultivators were induced to shift over to valuable crops like cotton, canes, poppy, and indigo. Broadly speaking, agriculture in India in medieval times depended primarily on monsoon rains. Even today, we find that the cultivators are largely dependent on the monsoon rains, although many part of India is now having canal irrigation based on modern big dams. But in medieval times and early modern times, the cultivators depended primarily on the monsoon rains. There was also, these monsoon rains filled up the tanks, the reservoirs, the ponds, the wells, and which was later used for irrigation. However, once the Delhi Sultanate rule was established, whose major emphasis was on the extraction of revenue, artificial irrigation also began to play an important role. So in the upper Gangetic basin, we find that the wells formed a major means of irrigation. And both Jiyauddin Birni and Ibn Battuta inform us that when, under Tughlaqs, especially under Muhammad Shah Tughlaq, in Delhi and Doab region, when it was ravaged by famine, the Sultan ordered the peasants to dig wells, and they were also financed for it. So most of these wells during those years were kacha wells, and Afif mentions that when a canal was dug, The baked brick wells were dug alongside the canal, where at a depth of some 2 meters one could get water. The traditional wells predominated the Middle Ganga Basin. So Middle Ganga Basin was already having number of wells in the entire area. Even during the Delhi Sultanate period, these wells continued. So there is no doubt that the core of Delhi Sultanate, which was largely the area in the western Uttar Pradesh and the part of Punjab, this entire area was full of rivers all around, both because you have the Ganges flowing and then the various rivers of Punjab flowing all around. But and even in the Middle Ganga Basin, you have many rivers flowing all around. But half the year, especially in the upper part of the upper Gangetic Basin, these rivers were dry. In the Middle Gangetic Basin, you will find the rivers were flowing. Not all the rivers, but especially the Ganges, had enough water. But the free character of the rivers in the basin affected the economy of the region, which the Delhi Sultanate expanded into. Therefore, the wells acted as the largest network of field irrigation during those years. Ibn Battuta refers to the Kacha wells, the Kacha unbricked wells. Possibly, these Kacha wells were dug temporarily on the vantage points of the cultivable land, and they went out of the use once the crops were harvested. Later, when Babur came to India and established the Mughal kingdom here, he found very little running water and peasant dependent more on wells. So he's talking about the northwestern part of India, basically, because he has come to northwest part of India and established his capital at Agra. So he's talking about this part of India where he finds very little running water. Babur mentions that the Ravi River belt of Lahore and Dipalpur, there were a huge number of wells. And he mentions this in his Babur Nama. And the wells were not very deep, and water was lifted through the cord made of grass. We do not get any reference to big projects like canal irrigation or excavation in Rajasthan area, which was a dry area. So not much effort was taken by any of the Delhi sultans or even by the later Mughal rulers. So we have actually references to such account in many of the Persian narratives. Obviously, there is a debate about the technology of irrigation during those period, what kind of technologies were already existing in India, and the way, you know, many historians believe that new technologies were introduced by the Delhi Sultans. So there is a big debate. So you have views of Irfan Habib, who talks about the Persian wheels, whereas Chetan Singh believes that, you know, this was already in existence. So we are not going into the details of these debates, but let me tell you that, you know, instead of studying the history of medieval and early modern period on the basis of these chronicles, so instead of understanding the history more of a political type, more of an economic type, we can also read these sources to understand the irrigation pattern, to understand the wild animals, to understand the forest area, to understand the untilled land and the expansion of the cultivable land. Now, it is in these aspects that the historian of the time may not have been, and his prejudices may not have been so influential, or it had may not have peeped into the writings of those chroniclers. So, you know, we can actually rely on the information provided by these chroniclers to understand these aspects of nature, which can give us a new way of understanding history. The expansion of states and their consolidation entailed the collection of revenue and rents from the cultivators. Also, it raised the larger questions like how to deal with the larger number of people who were not actually cultivators. So the campaigns of Sultan like Balban, that we get evidence in many of the chronicles, against the Mewatis in the Doab area, were also about displacing and destroying one kind of landscape and replacing it with another. So drovers of woodcutters were auxiliaries of his military force. And along with the enslaved captives, they helped these woodcutters helped set up the settlements with revenue-free lands for loyalists and the cultivators. So these woodcutters were used for clearing the land. So this actually facilitated the movement of the caravans with roads and sarais. The transformation of jungle to the city in the area around Qutb near Delhi in less than a century, ending in the 1320s, was a major accomplishment of the Sultans of Delhi. And sources suggest that Sultan Balban deployed Tabarzan, were woodcutters, in the Mewat area and in the Doab area to clear the forests. Chroniclers like Ziauddin Birni write about the sufferings inflicted on the many of the local tribes. Like you have a tribe called Kathrian, who were basically the possessor of cashew. So these were probably pastoralists relying more on the forest and the forest products. So they were also affected by these expansion of agricultural land into the forest area. Historians, in recent study done by a historian called who has worked on Gujarat, the regional history of Gujarat, Samira Sheikh, the author actually details the ways in which the emergence of regional kingdom in Gujarat required close engagement with pastoralists and tribals. So instead of emphasizing more on the nobility, on the sultan, on the history of, you know, the economic expansion and the policies followed by the sultans, we can talk about the close connections, the close engagements with the pastoralists and the tribals in, you know, these regional kingdoms. So during 13th and 14th century, for example, Samira Sheikh mentions rulers got the bheels to police the mountain passes and forests, even as they sent the charans with the caravans to help protect them from raids. So she actually cautions that the very little separated a chieftain from the neighboring bhils or kolis, who were also cultivators and pastoralists, or they were living on the coast, and they were, you know, there were communities who were fishing communities, there were some kind of trading communities. So these were not separated. They were very much connected. It was precisely by taking control of such regions that the rulers kind of made an attempt to force a region into a stable political unit. So she talks about the Charutar area, which is now the Anand, which is a milk producing Amul milk cooperative society established there in Gujarat. So this area was settled with Kanbis who tilled the land, but only after subduing the Kolis in the area. The separation of land and their uses, the classification and the associated identities can have a very consequential impact on the polity and the social hierarchy. So that's why it is essential that we also try to study such aspects when we study the history of medieval and early modern times. This can also be done on the basis of the vernacular sources, and the scholarship drawing on vernacular sources show a long-term set of processes of acculturation and reinvention in which the different smaller caste categories or the farmers or, you know, the forest frontiers showed enormous fluidity and flexibility. We can, if we read these vernacular literatures, we can also understand the way the river societies lived. And despite the enormous power exerted by the later on established colonial state in the 19th century, who attempted to actually tame the various nature things, like they tame the forest, they tame the rivers. So they tried to actually limit the frontiers. But despite that, such fluidity and flexibility remained a feature of Indian society, which continued even in the later centuries. So we cannot actually understand the history of, you know, the history of India only by dividing and understanding history such as ancient, medieval and modern. Because in order to understand these nature aspects, you have to sometimes cross these divides. As I told you that many of the Mughal accounts and many of the Delhi Sultanate accounts give indirect references to the wild animals. Obviously, the idea of colonial era, that's why, you know, this course has been taken up to the 1850. It doesn't stop at 1800. We go well into the 19th century also, because the idea of obviously very, very creation of colonial or very establishment of British colonial state does not mean that there was, you know, a complete departure from the earlier existing systems. If we try to understand these nature aspects, we will find that there were certain areas where we find some kind of continuities. So this colonial state, or is many historians believe that it was a watershed moment, but there are many aspects which actually was not a watershed moment, which did not experience the watershed moment. So it was not a complete sharp break. Obviously, it was a sharp break in terms of, you know, forest, the exploitation of forest. If we look at the history of the exploitation of forest, even in those terms, we find that it took time. So mere establishment of colonial rule did not actually lead to exploitation of forest on a massive scale. It was only in the 19th century that we find that the exploitation of the forest resources started on a massive scale. Similarly, when it comes to the taming of the rivers, when it comes to exploiting the fisheries introduction of many acts and laws. It is only in the 19th century that such changes were introduced. So even, you know, in terms of relationship with the nomadic tribes, the itinerary groups, the crackdown on the Sweden cultivators, these were all measures which came later on in the 19th century. So in that sense, what I feel is that it is very essential for us to to understand these histories through new approaches. So these sharper lines of distinctions, in terms of periodizations, is not a correct way to understand these histories. It may be correct in terms of political history or economic histories, but when we talk about nature, when we talk about various nature aspects, this kind of a categorization actually does not fit in. So in order to understand India's environmental past, it is essential that we engage with different period, with different time periods. So we have to cross these eras, the eras that we created, the humans have created, the ancient divide, the ancient medieval, modern divides, or even the colonial era or the post-colonial era. All these have to be, in terms of themes like wild animals, in terms of themes like rivers, we have to keep crossing these periods, and we have to engage with sometimes with the past and come back into the medieval and modern, early modern period. So this way we can understand the history of Eastern India in a much fruitful and interesting way.